It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 78 for Friday, the 1st of June, 2012. On the show this week, would you trust Volvo to let an autonomous car drive down a motorway? Someone did, because it just happened. Also, what's the significance of this? And this? I'll give you a hint, they've both been in the news this week. And do you want to camp next to the skeleton of a Diplodocus and eat insects in a museum? If the answer's yes, then boy do we have some news for you. All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan Gear.
Namaste.
And thank you. And associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Oh, we're back. We're back. Well, I'm back.
Well, you're back.
You guys did an amazing job of the podcast last week. I had no hand in it and I got to listen to it on the plane home. Bad flight back from Seattle.
How bad?
Like 9 hours of solid turbulence.
Oh,
and Duncan had sent
grief.
Me this challenge, Liv, I don't know if you know, to try and compose a piece of music on GarageBand.
Yes.
On the iPad while flying. And as good as that idea is in principle, turns out it's extremely difficult to play a virtual piano using a touchscreen during turbulence.
Yeah. I presume you're mostly focusing on controlling your bowels.
I was mostly I suppose so.
I was broadly sympathetic about this, but on the other hand, you can just kind of like play the chords. You can set it to sort of auto-play the actual bits.
But that's cheating.
Or you could have just mashed the screen with your kind of panic-stricken paws.
Will you play the podcast listeners a little sample of what you came up with?
No, absolutely not. But anyway, I'm back. I've been picking the juiciest items from the Wired.co.uk news tree, and I'm ready to make an information smoothie. Let's take a sip. Duncan.
What was the juiciest?
Well, the juiciest was that Volvo has successfully tested an autonomous road train, hasn't it?
It has.
Tell me more.
So this is a trio of driverless Volvo cars that managed to successfully traverse 200 kilometres of motorway surrounded by other cars in Spain.
Wow. How?
How?
Sensor-ridden car, I suspect.
Yes, they had cameras and radars and lasers in each car that was keeping track of the vehicle in front and allowing it to remain at a safe distance and auto-correct course when necessary. And they were basically all following this lead vehicle, which in this case was a lorry, which sent back acceleration and braking and steering data so that the train was able to act entirely in unison.
Oh, I see. So it actually does rely that there's a van in front for it to trail.
There has to be a lead car of some sort that has a driver in it that can do its thing. But then the other ones that can just, like the drivers in those, if there is anyone in them, can just sit back and eat a sandwich and
drink
booze. Yeah, have a Christmas pudding.
Text.
And when you say road train, this means a series of cars.
Yes.
A convoy.
A convoy, exactly. It is exactly like a convoy. The three cars followed this lorry for 200 kilometres at a speed of about 80 kilometres an hour, with just 6 metres between them at each point.
And, I mean, this is amazing. What's the point? What are they aiming to do here?
Well, the point is to reduce fuel consumption, reduce the risk of accidents.
Well, hang on, fuel consumption. They're still powered. They're still fueled, aren't they?
Yeah, but by acting entirely in unison, there's not any of the kind of like the braking and stuff caused by human error in between. So
Super efficient driving.
Exactly.
Right?
It's the most efficient kind of driving because it's being done by computers.
I guess Volvo's got that sensing tech where it can sense if there's something in front of it and it can automatically stop. In principle, I've seen it go wrong. Rather disastrous results, but I assume it's got some of that involved as well.
Well, in this case, it doesn't even need to do that. The lead vehicle just sends back a signal saying I'm braking at this rate, and then all the other cars brake at exactly the same rate at exactly the same time.
I see.
So there's no need to detect that the car in front is braking. It just automatically receives the signal saying brake.
How is this different from the kind of experiments that Google's been doing in Nevada in the US?
Well, what Google's been doing hasn't been so much about road trains. It's been about individual cars that can scan its surroundings, it knows where it is, and it can drive from one place to another. This is more about, as I say, sort of trains going off on one long...
Is road train a term that people use normally, or have they invented this term?
To describe this, yeah, it's been used quite widely. I mean, the project that has been looking after this, that Volvo's been working with, is called SARTRA, which stands for Safe Road Trains for the Environment.
I think it's an antonym of rail car. Maybe.
Maybe. But the technology has been tested lots and lots of times before on private tracks, but this was actually the first time that the trains were able to get onto a public road surrounded by the lollygagging Luddites of other drivers.
Wow, interesting. And they're adding a fourth car, I think, the end of this year?
They want to, yes. By the end of 2012, they want to put a fourth car onto the end of the train. And,
excellent. We'll have to... I can't think of a pun for this. Just watch out for more information on that. Liv, we heard this sound at the start of the show. What is this sound and why is it significant?
Well, that is the dulcet tones of an old rotary telephone.
Sure is.
And this is one of the sounds that a guy called Brendan Chilcutt has stored in his online museum of sounds from devices that are either obsolete or soon to be obsolete.
The Museum of Endangered Sounds, no less.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent name.
And it's a website, and you go there and you can see, I think there's only 15 sounds at the moment, but they include things like the bleeps of a Tamagotchi that needs attention. Or the buzzing of a floppy disk drive, which is actually a sound that I quite miss.
Yeah, I like the modem sounds from old.
And then things like a VHS being sucked into the VCR. So yeah, he wants to preserve these sounds because obviously, you know, as we move towards touchscreens, even the sounds of kind of QWERTY keyboards, he suggests, might eventually be obsolete.
I like the idea of where this is going. I wonder what sort of sounds that we'll have archived from today in the future. Like, I don't know, the sound of a fingertip on a touchscreen.
Possibly.
The sound of, what else would we
Siri.
Archive? Siri. Duncan, what sound from today would you archive for the future? A time capsule, an audible time capsule for future generations. What do you have? I imagine we'd have maybe something
I'm
like...
I'm trying to think of one and I'm having difficulty.
Oh, I don't know if you need to archive it, but there's something magical about that sound of when you pop a the foil seal of a coffee pot.
Fairly sure that's been around for quite a while.
This
has. This is all tech, isn't it?
Yes, this is tech, but I was just thinking of other sounds that I might want to archive and...
You could do the kind of whirring that that the CD drive makes when it comes out of your computer and goes back in.
Yes, that's definitely going out.
That's pretty much going out the window now.
Or slide to unlock.
Being defenestrated.
Anyway, we could go on for about this for ages, but what's his plan here? Because he's going to do something interesting with this data.
Yeah, well, first of all, he's looking for more sounds. So he's got on his website, you can send in submissions of sounds that you want preserved. And he's going to collect these over the next 3 years. And then after that, he's trying to spend 7 years developing a markup language to reinterpret the sounds as a binary composition.
Wow. What does that mean?
Well, that's so they're preserved in a format that will forever be accessible.
Yeah, I guess so. There's no problem with MP3 decoding not being around in the future.
Is there any way of then using that markup language that he's done to...
Well, he hasn't made the markup
language yet. Well, when he does, will there be a way of kind of using that to kind of create your own songs, like turn it into the Rastamouse theme tune or something like that?
No plans revealed as yet, but quite possibly, yes.
That would be great. Rastamouse with telephone rotary dials and modem sounds.
What's his website, do we know?
Google Museum of Endangered Sounds and you'll be able to find it.
Or type it in on wire.co.uk's handy little search bar.
Exactly.
Duncan, hello. Tell me about extinction, mass extinction.
Extinction.
Death.
So this is a story that did quite well for us this week. This is the story of how 250 million years ago, pretty much everything just died.
Wow.
Sad.
That is sad.
It was pretty dramatic.
What was everything to die at that time?
Well, there was lots of stuff around then. There were sea scorpions, there were trilobites, there were certain types of starfish that haven't been seen since. What the event we're talking about here is the Permian-Triassic extinction, which was the mass extinction that happened between the Permian and the Triassic periods.
The biggest extinction in history.
That we are aware of, yes. It is the most catastrophic die-off of life that has ever happened on Earth. Only 1 in 10 species of plant and animal survived, and in the oceans that was even less. That was down to about something like 96% of stuff died.
That's a lot of death.
That is a lot of death. It was thought to have been caused by a combination of climate change and acid rain and ocean acidification and anoxia. Do you know what anoxia is? Should I explain
absence
that?
Absence of oxygen?
Correct, yeah. It's when the oceans become deoxygenized, and so stuff that needs oxygen in the oceans can't live. And that was a big reason why so many of the marine animals died.
Well, hang on then. So they didn't... This doesn't affect them all at once. It happens over time. Like, they gradually get wiped out.
Well, so, yeah, what will have happened is it took about 10 million years. So that's the actual bit of news here. I mean, the news isn't that this thing happened. The news is that a pair of geologists have been examining analyses of rock sections, two chaps called Michael Benton and Zongqiang Chen, and they reckon that it took Earth 10 million years to fully recover from all these incidents. And part of the reason is because it happened in bursts over 5 or 6 million years. So it will, like, all that nasty stuff happened, and then it happened again, and then again, and between those, these ecosystems tried to recover, but they couldn't because they kept getting hit back by another event.
I see. So species would get close to being extinct or being wiped out, but not quite, would sort of populate
and then
again.
Bounce back a little bit and then get completely knocked out.
It's like Alan Partridge's career.
A little bit. But what was really, really interesting is what happened afterwards. The species that managed to emerge from these events, the 10% of life that survived, is what formed the basis of modern style ecosystems. In the sea, that was crabs and lobsters and the very first marine reptiles. And on land, it was tetrapods that eventually became the dinosaurs. So without this mass extinction, we wouldn't have had, life wouldn't have developed in exactly the same way.
So we can actually learn something from these extinctions?
Yes, absolutely. This is the only mass extinction thought to have significantly affected insects. Benton himself said, in this most devastating case, life did recover after many millions of years and new groups emerged. It reset evolution. But he says the causes of the killing, this global warming, this acid rain, this ocean acidification, do sound eerily familiar to what's happening to the planet today. And maybe we can learn something from these ancient events.
Interesting.
What could we learn? That we are going to die and be gone for 10 million years.
That there's a very good chance that the next mass extinction is happening right now.
Okay.
Eek. Well, speaking of eek, rocks that are disguised sensors. That's the topic of our next story. America is supposed to be winding down the war in Afghanistan by 2014, but the US Army may continue to monitor the movements of Afghans using sensors disguised as rocks.
I love
benign
this.
Objects. Yeah, these could be buried in the ground. They could sit for a couple of decades, potentially, gathering solar power. Basically, they'll be inactive when not in use. When something that they detect comes by, or rather, when they detect something coming by that, you know, it fires up, it can send a report to, I don't know, the Pentagon, I imagine. And then they could, you know, America could zoom in with a drone or something like that and investigate whatever's caused suspicion in this faux rock.
So given the kind of the massive omni-shambles that the whole Afghanistan war has been, is the objective here basically just to gather more information so that they can analyze that and then I guess sort of cross-reference it with suspicious behavior?
Yeah, I mean it's basically a surveillance technology, and it's actually not limited to sort of Afghanistan. I mean these could be used sort of outside corporate headquarters. It could be used around military bases in I don't know, we could use one in here to find out if anyone's talking about us outside the office.
I love what you said about corporate headquarters. That's kind of interesting. I can see, you know, an employee slipping in late to work and hoping he won't be noticed. And then, there's a rock. Did it see me?
this reminds me of a terrifying scene in Return to Oz, if anyone's watched it, where they have these rocks which have these little eyes that glimmer from, you know, glint from left to right as you walk past.
What kind of like a startled meerkat sort of thing?
No, they're more kind of sinister, as in, I know what you're doing and I'm going to report back to my boss, the Gnome King, who's equally terrifying. But anyway, I digress.
That's a good metaphor for the US Army.
What, Gnome Kings?
Yeah.
So who developed these? Who built them?
This is developed by Lockheed Martin, massive, in fact, I think the largest defense contractor in the world. They've been building stuff for the US military for decades. And these things are really low powered and went much lower power than past models. And these, like the types of technology, this sort of hidden surveillance devices have been used for decades, but they tend not to be as sophisticated as this, and these ones could potentially last for, you know, as long as 20 years, it's suggested, because they take on solar power. They don't need to be powered when they're not in use. I mean, some people have been saying that it's not necessarily the case because they require bigger batteries to last that amount of time, and, you know, if they have bigger batteries, then they're inherently not as easy to hide, I guess. But it's a really interesting use of technology, and, you know, it means that we're always being listened, Liv.
So yeah, is it a saying that the walls have ears? In this case, the rocks have...
I think it's the walls have eyes.
Walls have eyes. Well, in this case, the rocks have ears.
The hills
ears.
Have eyes.
So yes, watch out for that rock. Is he moving? No, but he could be listening. Liv, Kickstarter campaigns. We always love these. We've got a one to do with music this week.
We have. It's actually been one that was first launched about a year ago, and it was to create a public domain score and recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations, some little tunes written by Bach a few hundred years ago. The problem with classical music is, although Bach's been long dead, every every studio recording has its own copyright attached to it. So there aren't actually any kind of openly available Creative Commons licensed recordings or scores available. So this was the aim of this project, was to raise $15,000 and then record these particular songs, the Goldberg Variations.
This is a fantastic use for crowdfunding, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's great. So this is because, although I didn't mean to sound quite so dismissive.
That's okay.
Because Bach's been dead for hundreds of years, the copyright on the original, the songwriting,
yes,
has expired, but the copyright on the recordings still exists, and
exactly.
That's why we need public domain recordings, correct?
Exactly. And there weren't that many recordings of 300 years ago. So no. We don't have
they
any
might,
of those.
They might have had a Glockenspiel or something like that that they could record it on. But.
Exactly.
So they've met their funding goal.
Yes.
What's the next step?
So a pair of called Robert Douglas and a pianist called Kimiko Ishizaka. I think that's how you pronounce it. Sorry if it isn't. They met the funding goal. They wrote the score, which they had to kind of crowdsource. And I'm not entirely clear why they had to write the score, I guess, to release...
So I think to make,
that.
I guess to make copies. Or, I don't know.
And then they recorded the music on a Bösendorfer piano. Apparently, that's a pretty good one. And then they've released it entitled "The Open Goldberg Variations" onto SoundCloud. So, and you can download it as well.
Can we hear some?
We can.
Yes, we can. Okay, here's some. Pleasing to the ears.
Lovely, very yeah. relaxing.
Soothing to the mind.
And they've released it under the Creative Commons Zero license, which is the kind of loosest license of them all. And it means that anyone can take it, download it, record it, mash it up, use it however they so choose.
Or play it underneath Olivia_Solon in a podcast.
It's the Zero license, I think, is designed to be as close to public domain as it's possible to be
yes.
in countries that don't have support for a public domain in their law.
Yes.
Interesting. This didn't someone do this with Beethoven?
Yeah, there's another project that's ongoing. I think they're trying to do the recordings called Musopen, which is with Beethoven, Brahms, Sibelius and Tchaikovsky.
Ah,
is that how you pronounce Sibelius?
It is
Sibelius.
Now. I'm not sure.
Well, it is now.
Well, it's time for us to glissando into an ad break. But when we come back, it's time to get down and dirty with a bit of Sleeping with the Dinosaurs.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Dino snores, Duncan. Best name, I think, ever for any kind of museum event.
It's pretty good.
Because it is to do with snoring next to the dinos. Dino snores... For grown-ups.
Really, is it?
It is. Is an adults-only sleepover that's coming to the Natural History Museum. And
sexy time.
Well, perhaps. But it's going to be the first they've ever done. And it has apparently resulted from the fact that every time they do this for kids every month, the parents are basically like, I want to come. Do I really have to bring children? So they have done this in response. That's honestly, that's what they said. That's what they told me. I went over. And so they're going to have 200 adults, up to 200 adults, camping around the Dippy, which is the Diplodocus, however you want to pronounce it, in the Natural History Museum's entryway, and then have a night of activities, which includes insect tasting, and they're going to have scientists on hand. They've got, what else have they got? They've got some competitions. They've got ghost stories being read by Clementine Wade at 2:30 in the morning.
Awesome.
And obviously a bar, because it's for grown-ups. And you can explore the museum a bit, see some of the exhibits, and... They've got life drawing class, actually. I wasn't sure what that had to do with natural history.
Now, you say camping. Are there going to be tents?
No, I mean, it'd be sort of sleeping bags and air mattresses, I imagine. I mean, it's a really big entranceway. It's very large. You could certainly cater for 200 people. And so you'll get there and have a three-course meal. And then I think you've got sort of a choice of things you can do if you want to do some insect tasting. Or they've got this crime... They do this crime scene thing every month or every so often, I think, where they create kind of a... You know, a grisly murder in the museum, and you have to use forensic tools and things to solve who did the.
Who do they murder?
Well, it's a fake murder, but they have all sort of, you know, they were saying they go to the butchers and they get like bits of brains and eyeballs, and they
set
up like really proper full on. They call it crime scene live, I think, and they have actual barristers to sort of judge whether you've got the right guy and all that sort of stuff, which is really cool. So they're bringing a portion of that in. And what's interesting, the lady who sort of manages that and is managing it for this is called Heather Bonney. And I met up with her actually at the Natural History Museum, and she has a really interesting job. She is apparently, well, she's a forensic anthropologist. She's the only one based in a museum and regularly helps police when they sort of when a building has been demolished and they find a dead body under the ground. She goes along and helps the police to help them identify whether it's sort of a body that's been shoved there because of a murder
or a historical
one or a graveyard that was accidentally built on or however that happens. And she's going to be there and they're using sort of forensic tools and all these kinds of stuff, you know, at night with alcohol. for grown-ups only.
I think my favourite thing about this is the way that they specified that this event was not suitable for stag and hen parties.
Yeah.
I can just sort of see this rampage going off through the museum.
Riding where, Dippy, the Diplodocus.
And ending up with some melted robot dinosaur doppelganger just lying on the floor of the museum just going...
Yeah. Pretty much. I've written a piece sort of about the background of this and spoke to some of the people involved and what they're doing and why and things like that. If you search for Dino Snores on Wired, you will find the story. And it's on early June. It's about 175 quid.
So kind of pricey.
It's kind of pricey. I think members get a bit of a discount, but I'm dead tempted to go, I have to say.
I think you could drink your money's worth.
Well, I think you'd probably have to pay for the alcohol too.
Oh.
I guess. I don't know. But you get free insect food, so you can eat at least. Duncan. Let's move on. Let's talk about Chrome OS, Google's operating system.
Yeah, they've refreshed their Chromebooks and introduced the desktop version.
Yeah, this is the operating system that's basically the Chrome web browser. Chrome web browser. It came out a year or so ago, I think done reasonably well. And now they're releasing a desktop computer, as you say, from Samsung.
Mm.
So it strikes me that if it's been successful enough for them to make a desktop machine, iteration.
I think we're still in the stages where they're trying lots of different things. They're looking around. They're you know, putting out lots of different form factors and stuff to see what sticks. I think they've certainly found that the laptops that they've made have done okay. But what's really interesting, I think, about Chrome OS is that it's not so much for tech geeks. Like almost every operating system that gets launched is for tech geeks, whereas Chrome OS is great and everything, but it's actually the artificial limits that it puts in, that, you know, just limiting you to a web browser, for example, are perfect for the kind of your dad and your gran that just you don't want them phoning you up every half an hour to ask a tech problem.
But this is an experience we've both had, because I think we've actually both given our parents Chromebooks.
I gave my mum one at Christmas.
So we've all given our parents Chromebooks.
And have any of us fielded a tech support query since?
There was one issue with Wi-Fi, but apart from that, no.
Actually, I had one query now I think about it, about Wi-Fi. Yeah, but it's been successful. But what I wonder is that this is sort of the market that the iPad was supposed to be tackling and certainly has penetrated well. So I wonder how much life the Chromebook can have. Now we have, you know, the iPad in its third iteration with things like, you know, iPhoto, and it's very, very, very easy to use. I know that my mum loves the iPhone.
Yeah. I mean, the question is whether it's sustainable, whether it's unlikely to be sustainable, whether it's going to kind of like last until the heat death of the universe or whatever, or whether it's just going to be a couple of years and then be superseded by something from Apple or something else that comes along.
Yeah. What do you think, Liv? Would you use them?
Well, no, it's not that I wouldn't use it. I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of developed the kind of apps that they have and made it, and because we're all moving to the cloud in terms of lots of offices are and using kind of cloud apps instead of old desktop based apps, and I think it'd be interesting to see if they just make a more sophisticated product that could work in the workplace for collaborative working, and in which case it could get better uptake.
Well, you know, I think you've stumbled upon something quite interesting there, which is the sort of business applications for a device like this, because one of the great features of Chrome OS, particularly on a laptop, is that no data really is stored locally.
Yeah.
Everything is stored in the cloud. It's on Google servers. You have to log in. If you don't log in, you're not letting your laptop potentially get into the hands of ill-doers. It's just not on the machine.
They're enormously secure machines.
Very secure, because they are essentially dumb terminals. They're thin clients. They pull all the data from the cloud. So if you lose one in a corporate environment, you're not necessarily at as much risk as you would be if you lost a PC or a Mac.
Yeah.
You know, as secure as they are in their own right, they are not as secure inherently as something that doesn't have any data physically on it.
And that's not something that the iPad is as secure as, for example.
No, I mean, devices, the iPad, phone, I mean, Blackberries, I mean, they've been built to support remote wiping. So if it does fall into the wrong hands, you can remotely erase it. But that still requires that the device has to be online in some capacity. You can't send a kill switch if the thing can't actually respond to that. Whereas with this, if you're not using it, it has no data on it. effectively. So and they're dirt cheap compared to, you know, even a sort of modestly priced business machine.
Well, there was a bit of debate over the price of these machines, and there were a bunch of people on Twitter that I saw the other day complaining about the price, saying it was too much. It was I think like £350-370, something like that,
at the moment, because they're being pitched still to consumers as kind of a low-cost PC, not necessarily to businesses who would buy in bulk in their hundreds or even thousands, deploy them across a network. I mean, I think there's a real opportunity there for a device like this to be given to people who do work out in the field quite a lot. You know, I mean, we should give them to our government, because my God, do they lose stuff.
But the massive stumbling block of all of this is that although you're right that everything's stored in the cloud and everything, it's not your cloud, it's Google's cloud. Google has access to your data, and there are going to be a lot of companies, the companies that have the biggest sort of security requirements, that's going to be a deal breaker for them.
Yeah. Potentially, but I mean, think about it another way. Google, how many times have you heard of a serious data breach going on in Google Docs, for example, versus how many times have someone lost a USB key, left a laptop on a train?
But it's more of a principle thing.
Absolutely, but I think there's a precedent set by the fact, well, not a precedent as such, but I think there's certainly you know, historic data to suggest that that is a more secure way to handle private data than locally storing it on a machine that's physically leavable on a train.
And I think also Google is actively making inroads into the business market to replace Office with Google Docs, not as a, you know, complete substitute for kind of desktop based apps, but it has definitely been making an aggressive move into that space. So if it could then get in there with the hardware as well, it'd be quite interesting.
Well, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Do you use a Chromebook? Do you like it? Do you see there's a future there? Are you a businessman? Do you want to deploy them in your institute?
Or women.
Well, business person, yes.
or do you think it's as unsavory as a urinal cake? We want to hear from you. podcast@wired.co.uk.
We do. Liv, one more story we want to cruise into before we leave the news. Thunderclap.
Yes. This, well, quite. It's quite an interesting
Was that supposed to sound like thunder?
Yeah.
No. This is thunder.
Liv, tell us. What's going on?
You're going to put in a sound effect there, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Thunderclap is a new platform that works a little bit like Kickstarter, but for sort of activism. It's created by a company called DD Group. And how it works is you, as a person, you can set up a little profile page for a particular cause, a political cause or anything that you so wish. So, I don't know, I hate actor. And then you can create a tweet, and then you get others to pledge to tweet that message. So you can say, I want 500 people to support this particular cause. And so what people do is they pledge a tweet, they stockpile all of those tweets as more and more people pledge, and then they unleash them all at exactly the same time, so that single tweet that people have, you know, say that they support will be tweeted en masse to create a bigger impact for their particular cause.
Interesting. And people have done this already, I think.
So at the moment there's a couple of projects online. One is about lobbying senators to not let the banks get rid of proposed financial reform in the US. So it's a message that's targeting a couple of particular senators. But then at the same time, there's some kind of more product-based ones which are a little bit lame and likely to be more annoying, such as Amy Winehouse's dad, who's hawking out a book about his own daughter, who, as we know, died last year, this year. So I guess it's kind of the question is whether this is going to be really irritating, or is it just a very useful tool for slacktivism to make a big impact, get something trending, and, you know, perhaps make action happen. No, that's not right.
I mean, the answer is that it's going to be really annoying. Well, you'll be doing nothing, and then suddenly there'll be 50 tweets in your timeline.
But that kind of happens anyway. But at least it happens.
It happens spread out over a period of time, rather than just boom all at once.
Well, no, but if something like there's an Apple Macworld going on, that's kind of happens to your timeline.
That's true. I mean, the events thing is kind of interesting. Like, I can see them, because correct me if I'm wrong, but this is just about numbers. You once you get to a certain number, all of them get unleashed, correct?
Well, I think you can set a date as well, so that you can set a target, and you want to get at least 500. And like Kickstarter, you can overshoot that target, and then on the day that you want to push it out, you push it out.
So, like on World Tapir Day, like all the people over the last six months who've said, "I really love tapirs," they can tweet it out automatically. They don't have to remember that day is World Tapir Day.
Exactly.
Okay.
Interesting. Though I can see this getting massively abused. I can also see, if it gets popular, Twitter coming out with some sort of usage guideline where they block this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Auto-tweeting.
I imagine they'll all have a hashtag, and it's reasonably simple to block hashtags.
Yeah, I think
with TweetDeck and so on.
I think they would just block the API, because this site would have to use Twitter's API in order to automate tweets. They could just block them. They have to comply to terms and conditions in order to use that API.
See, I wouldn't mind it if it's for political causes, for stuff that you would likely to support anyway, but what would I think would be irritating is when brands get wind of the idea, realize that they can game the trending topics by doing this, so they can then do it as part of their ad campaign and then say that they were trending in the UK and on this day because they've just forced all these
for
tweets
for 30 seconds while all the tweets came out, and
exactly,
then they stopped being trending
and then they go, and I think that would get a bit boring.
Well, we want to hear from you, Amen, what you think, whether you think this is a wonderful idea or whether you think it's a couple of kittens short of a basket. You can email us at podcast@wired.co.uk or tell us on Facebook or on Twitter.
Better still, we could just set one up for ourselves. Let's spam the world about the podcast.
We could do, couldn't we?
I mean, there's so many spammers in the world. Let's have a piece of that pie, shall we? Let's chow down on that success story for our own benefit. No, let's not.
But presumably it'll be fewer people would support it than the number of followers we have on our own Wired UK account. So a bit pointless.
A little bit pointless.
Okay. Well, let's leave the news. We are going to welcome in my print editor counterpart, David Rowan, to talk about a massive new feature we've got in this month's new magazine called the Wired 100. David Rowan, editor of Wired magazine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nate.
So we have made a list called the Wired 100. Do it every year. What is it exactly? Why do we do this?
It's our attempt to reflect what the wider Wired community sees as the 100 most influential people in this world. So it's a bit of a crowdsourced effort, and we try and make it as scientific as you possibly can make it, which probably means it's going to be flawed, but it starts a conversation. So what we do is it's the third year we've done this, we go to a couple of hundred people plus the community at Wired Co. UK, and we ask them, who, with a connection to the UK, a strong connection, do you think is influential at this moment in the last 365 days? And we start off by going to last year's Wired 100. We contact all of them. We say, do you want to name up to 10 people who should be higher up the list, 10 who should be lower, 10 who should be in who weren't there, and 10 maybe who should be out? Then we go to our web community. We get their input. Then we go to the Wired team to go through their networks to get some names, people we might not have been aware of. And we compile this huge spreadsheet with hundreds of names, and then we look for patterns. So if some people have been named a number of times and they weren't in last time, that's a pretty good signal that they should be on our radar. And then using the high-tech methodology of tiny bits of paper stuck with blue tack on the office wall, we put them in what seems to be the fairest order based on all the feedback we're getting.
And this year, notably, on the cover is entry number one, or position number one, Sir Jonathan Ive, now the head of industrial design at Apple. Interesting choice. Why is Johnny at number one?
So we debated this for a while, and Johnny Ive doesn't live here, but he has base here. He has strong connections with the UK design world, you know, the RCA and places. He's been more visible in the last year, giving talks, for instance. And he's influenced most of our lives in ways that are pretty visible. So last year, the UK head of Facebook was top of the list. Previously, it was the head of Google in the UK. We just thought that because of his influence and his strong UK connections, Jonathan Ive is more influential than anybody else on that list. And if you disagree, tell us. We want that debate to continue.
And that's it. We've got a web address, wired.co.uk/2012wired100. That'll take you to a page where you can leave our feedback. Or leave your own feedback, in fact. Quick question, David. Why are we not in it?
It's quite uncomfortable seeing these media power lists in other publications where the editor of that publication is incredibly high, or friends of the publisher, or friends of friends. So we thought we will be as transparent as possible. And we said that anybody with a direct connection as an employee to Condé Nast or to Wired wouldn't be part of that list. And it's not because we're an incredibly humble company.
No.
There are some pretty influential people in the Condé Nast world, but it just seemed wrong.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time out. I know the magazine's on sale now. It's on the iPad. In fact, it's funnily enough, the guy at number one designed the product that our iPad edition, our tablet edition runs on. Some nice serendipity there.
And anybody who isn't in the list who thought they should be, the answer we're giving is they're number 101.
I see.
Just tell them.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thanks.
Liv, it's time for that time to happen where you tell people how they can get in touch and let us know what they think.
You can get in touch with us on the phone. You can call us on 0208 123 0468 and use a landline or mobile and it'll be UK local rate. Or you can use Skype to call us for free on Wired UK Podcast. That's our username, no spaces.
Both of those, leave 30-second messages. Please let us know what's going on.
You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. And then we have a lovely Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And as ever, we're also on email, so podcast@wired.co.uk.
And we'll swallow another wired.co.uk smoothie next week.
Bye.
Bye.
So what, I mean, what are some of the weird words that you've said today?
I was challenged by my Twitter followers to try and get various things into the podcast.
That's quite good. I didn't notice most of those.
How many did you get in? And let's see if people can count them all.
I did, for example, there was Tapir, there was Omni Shambles, Raster Mouse, something about the heat death of the universe, I think. If you can work out how many of the things, count them up during the podcast and tell us how many you think there were.
Should probably point out, it's only weird things Duncan said.
Yeah.
Not mine, they're just me. and emails, I guess, podcast@wired.co.uk.
If you get the correct number, I'll write down the correct number, and if you get it, then we'll send you something special.
Yeah, we will.
We'll pick
the correct number out of the hat, and we'll send you some cool stuff from our tech cupboard. We've got a lot of stuff that people might want. There you go. Surprise competition. Not the Moomin Scissors.
Anything but the Moomin Scissors.
There you go.
I've got the number.
It's a reward.
I'm thinking of it now.
Okay. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.